yo kama jana na juni. A for your sign a H. Kujuma wana bisho kwa na gaya kiche kuna vabuma. I wanna know kila kitu kina keep it on. Maybe it is yours, so tupo nyingine episode AYFA tunapiga rock.
Welcome to African Perspectives on CHRY 105.5 FM. You are listening to Amul Shivji, your host for today. African Perspectives seeks to inform our listening audience on news and views from the continent, be a platform for discussion on important issues from the continent. Our focus for this week's show is on the situation in Tunisia, as many of you must have heard on the news and everywhere else. So the headlines for today. At least 19 people have been injured after Algerian police broke up a banned pro-democracy demonstration in Algiers aimed at pressing the government to overturn a law banning public gatherings. Government officials say that hundreds of Algerians defied the ban and attempted to hold the demonstrations on Saturday, but were confronted by dozens of police armed with batons, tear gas and shields. The head of the Rally for Culture and Democracy, RCD, said at least 40 people were injured and dozens more were arrested in the demonstrations. His party's headquarters in the Algerian capital's main avenue had been put under siege by police, describing himself as a prisoner. Riots erupted in Algeria in early January over rising food costs and unemployment. 5 days of clashes between demonstrators and security forces left 5 people dead and more than 800 wounded. The unrest still simmers, and within the past 2 weeks, 8 people set themselves on fire in Algeria, although some cases were deemed to be linked to mental health issues. Thousands of demonstrators, including police officers, lawyers and students, have taken to the streets of Tunisia's capital, Tunis, in another day of unrest in the North African country. At least 2,000 police officers participated in Saturday's demonstrations, according to the news agency. They were joined by members of the National Guard and fire departments. More crowds gathered in front of the office of Mohamed Ghannouchi, the interim prime minister, on the avenue of Habib Bourguiba. In an effort to dampen the anger, the interim prime minister, Mohamed Ghannouchi, who is a former ally of the ex-president Ben Ali, pledged to quit politics after elections that he said would be held as soon as possible. In an interview in Tunisian television, Ghannouchi said he would leave power after transition phase that leads to legislative and presidential elections in the shortest possible time frame. 7 soldiers and commanders in the Army of the Democratic Republic of Congo have been arrested over allegations that were involved in a mass rape, according to the United Nations. 50 women have told the UN they were raped in the eastern town of Fizi on the night of January 1st this year. Madmome Munubi, a spokesman for MONUSCO, the UN mission in DRC, said the atrocities have been committed after a drunken soldier got into a dispute and attacked a civilian. The civilian was sent to the hospital, but the people around thought he had died, so they killed the soldier. The soldier's colleagues heard that he was killed and they went on a rampage in the village. They started to loot the village, to loot the stores and to rape the women. South Sudan has won the majority of votes needed in order to become the world's newest state, with just 60% of results declared from a landmark referendum. According to the AFP, at least 2 million votes for a separation of the mainly Christian African South from the mainly Muslim Arab North had been counted from the previous night. In Juba, which is now poised to become South Sudan's national capital, cheers and applause rang out as the head of the country's referendum subcommittee announced a 97.5% majority for independence. An application by 2 South African groups for the arrest of Tzipi Livni, the former Israeli foreign minister, who was due to visit the country later this week, has been turned down by the South African Police's Special Investigation Division. The Palestine Solidarity Alliance and the Media Review Network had called for Livni's arrest and prosecution for alleged war crimes over the role she played in Israel's war in Gaza. Spokesmen for the Directorate for Priority Crime Investigation say that the law required that Livni, who cancelled her visit earlier on Wednesday, be in the country for them to investigate. Livni cancelled her trip 2 weeks before her planned visit because of fear of being arrested, as reported by the Israeli media. The United Nations Security Council unanimously agreed to deploy 2,000 additional peacekeepers to the Ivory Coast, where the incumbent president and his rival are still at a political impasse, with the former refusing to relinquish power in the face of mounting international pressure. Different tactics have been used to try and convince Gbagbo to leave, including multiple visits by African leaders, sanctions, and the threat of a military ouster. Gbagbo refuses to step down, retaining control of government buildings, state television, and the security forces. He also holds a blockade around the Abidjan Hotel, where Ouattara is confined. ECOWAS hopes to consider all possible methods of engagement before resorting to the use of force. Security forces in Sudan have arrested opposition leader Hassan Al-Turabi from his home in Khartoum, Al-Turabi's popular Congress Party spokesman told the news. Monday's arrest came a day after Al-Turabi's party called for a popular revolution if the Sudanese government did not reverse price increases. Kenyan authorities have suspended three policemen after newspaper published a picture of an officer apparently shooting a man at point-blank range. Three men are said to have been shot dead in the incident, which took place in central Nairobi. The Kenyan police force has often been accused for carrying out extrajudicial killings. The country's internal security minister said he had ordered the police chief to suspend the accused officers with immediate effect. The United States was preparing for the end of former Tunisian President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali and assessing his potential successors as early as January 2006, a U.S. diplomatic cable released by WikiLeaks has revealed. None of the five possible successors identified by the U.S. Embassy in Tunisia, including current Prime Minister Ghannouchi, was likely to change Tunisia's policy or its relationship with the United States. The excited talk of a post-Ben Ali era, however, was muted in a series of four cables written 5 months later, also recently released by WikiLeaks. The death toll from South Africa's floods has continued to rise, follows weeks of heavy rains that began in December. 70 people have died and more than 8,000 families have been forced to leave their homes. Five other countries in the region, from Mozambique to Namibia, are on alert for further floods. South Africa has declared 8 of its 9 provinces disaster areas. At least 10 people have also died in floods in neighboring Mozambique, and more than 10,000 people have been evacuated from their homes. Burkina Faso has won the African Under-17 Soccer Championship after a 2-1 victory over host Rwanda in the final. Zanou Sana got the opening goal of the game in the 54th minute, pouncing on a poor back pass from Rwandan captain Faustin Usengimana. Rwanda equalized 10 minutes later with a stunning 25-yard shot from Tibingana Mwesige, but the Burkinabe restored their lead shortly afterwards through Kabore Abdulaziz. Burkina Faso spent much of the second half with only 10 men after the sending off Kanuze Basiro in the 59th minute. I would also like to add that this year commemorates 50 years since Patrice Lumumba's death. He was a Congolese independence leader and the first legally elected Prime Minister of the Republic of Congo after he helped win its independence from Belgium in June 1960. Only 10 weeks later, Lumumba's government was deposed in a coup during the Congo crisis. He was subsequently imprisoned and murdered in circumstances suggesting the support and complicity of the governments of Belgium and the United States. He was a true African nationalist. News from the continent is credited to Pambazuka News, the BBC, and Al Jazeera. If you've been following the news, then you would have heard that there is a real problem in Tunisia right now. Just to give you a little background for those people who don't know what's happening, on December 17th, a 26-year-old Tunisian man named Mohamed Bouazizi reached the end of his rope. An unemployed university graduate, Bouazizi had become a seller of fruits and vegetables in the southern Tunisian town of Sidi Bouzid. When authorities confiscated his wares to punish him for selling without a license, Bouazizi set himself on fire. He died in hospital on January 4, 2011. Bouazizi's suicide struck a chord with other frustrated Tunisians. Thousands took the streets in Sidi Bouzid to protest widespread unemployment, government corruption, and the lack of opportunity. Another frustrated youth in Sidi Bouzid, Lashin Naji, killed himself by climbing an electricity pylon while crying out, "No for misery, no for unemployment," before grasping the high-voltage line. The Tunisian government responded by sending baton and tear gas-wielding reinforcements to the city, and by promising future economic development projects. But riots have spread from Sidi Bouzid across the country, and the government has responded by closing the high schools and universities, arresting those they perceive to be ringleaders, and imposing a curfew. We'll be talking to Robert J. Prince, who is a lecturer in international studies at Corbell School of International Studies in University of Denver. He has his own blog at http://robertjprince.wordpress.com. where he discusses many issues ranging from Gaza to Saudi Arabia to Tunisia. Prince has served in Tunisia as a Peace Corps volunteer and a staff member. He has been with the University of Denver's Graduate School of International Studies, where he teaches full-time in their undergraduate international studies program, mostly courses on global political economy. And we will be listening to him when we come back from the commercial break. You are listening to CHRY 105.5 FM, and this is African Perspectives. I am Amla Shivji, your host for today. We have Mr. Rob Prince on the line. Hello, Rob.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. How are you?
I'm okay, thank you.
So, we'll just get straight into it. Could you give our listeners a brief history, a brief background of what's happening in Tunisia right now?
All right. Well, at this point, every day, the situation is evolving and changing. But basically, about a month ago, on December 17th, 2010, in a small town in the interior of Tunisia called Sidi Bouzid, a young man of 26 years of age who was selling fruit and vegetables without a permit, because he couldn't afford it, was stopped by the authorities, and his little fruit and vegetable stand was confiscated. He was roughed up. He complained to the local authorities, and when they basically threw him out of their office in frustration, he took a can of paint thinner and poured it over himself and lit a match and immolated himself. He died several weeks later. His name is Mohamed Bouazizi. And this particular incident was the, whatever you want to call it, the straw that broke the camel's back, and the whole flood of protests began, and these protests really focused on three issues which had been simmering for many, many years, three structural issues. One was high unemployment. Some say the official figure is 15%, but apparently it is much higher than that, youth unemployment being at least double that. And the second issue was corruption, particularly of the two leading families in the country, that of the then president, Zine Ben Ali and his wife. The family name is Trabelsi. Massive corruption on their part. And the third issue had been really several decades of what was a profound level of political repression that had often been either denied or played down by Western authorities, particularly in France and in the United States. So those issues came together in a protest movement. The protest movement started in the poorer areas of Tunisia, in the south and in the central highland area near the desert. And historically, protest movements in Tunisia have started in these poorer zones, but usually they don't exactly fizzle out. They're crushed by the government, and they don't reach the coastal cities in Tunis. This time, the protest movement basically flooded over to the entire country. And as it did, the repression against it mounted. We found, to everybody's surprise, or most everybody's surprise, I should say, a confrontation between the government of Tunisia and its people, which culminated in the president and his family leaving the country only 8 or 9 days ago, and now we're in an entirely new political situation. So all this caught most observers, I would say, by surprise. On the outside, and now we're in a new world, so to speak, uncharted waters in terms of Tunisia, and in a very positive manner, in the sense that this is really a profoundly a movement from deep inside Tunisia, from all classes, poor, working class, middle class, even beyond that. It's a really, in the old-fashioned terms, a united front effort to get rid of this regime, and it appears to have succeeded. For the most part, it has.
During the uprising, many people were relying on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube to gain news and coverage of Tunisia, as was in Iran. Google Trends actually shows a spike of attention that's lower than the attention Tunisia received for losing to Ukraine in the first round of the 2006 World Cup. Why do you think Tunisia isn't receiving the media attention it deserves?
Well, that's a very good question. Needless to say, when this happened, when we began to see the demonstrations in Iran a year ago, the day they began, it became international news. So in Tunisia's case, really, if we look at it in both the United States and France, I mean, New York Times didn't send anybody to Tunisia until it was all over, or just about. So what's going on here? Well, one is both the United States and France have important, what they consider to be important strategic ties with the Ben Ali regime. In the case of the United States, Tunisia's, it's not so much economically, but it's Tunisia's role in the war on terrorism. Tunisia has been involved in extraordinary rendition. Tunisian investigators have worked for American intelligence organizations, both in Iraq and in Afghanistan. The United States was concerned about that relationship, how that might change if Ben Ali was overthrown. In the case of the French, France has extensive economic ties and cultural and historical ties with Tunisia and with the Ben Ali regime. 1,400 French companies do business in Tunisia. Tunisia's main export target country is France. You have a large Tunisian population living in France. So both Sarkozy and the Obama administration were very, very hesitant to speak out and to criticize Ben Ali. And I think that's fundamentally the difference. They couldn't make up their mind until, in fact, they didn't make up their mind from what I could tell. What made up their mind was what was going on the ground, and then they basically decided they might as well go along with it because they couldn't do anything else. And then the New York Times started reporting and Le Monde started reporting. But it was really after the fact.
Secretary Clinton stated that the Washington won't take sides in the conflict, and she called for a quote-unquote a peaceful solution. However, one of Ben Ali's major supporters, as you said, was the U.S. White House. What role do you think the U.S. should play now in Tunisia?
Well, you're right about what Hillary Clinton said. Once Ben Ali left the country, it is true that President Obama did make a statement in support of the changes that had taken place. But I think I would make like three suggestions about how the United States should proceed in this situation. One, it should, like other countries have done, freeze the assets of the two ruling families, money that was basically stolen from the people of Tunisia. I don't think that the United States has the same kind of assets that Abu Dhabi has or Switzerland or France has in terms of Tunisian investments, but there's something. So that's the first thing. The second thing is I look at the economic situation that Tunisia has been gripped with, not only recently, but really since the end of the colonial period. And what's really needed in Tunisia is to change the structural relationship with Tunisia, if you like, as a peripheral zone producing cheap textiles and food products for a French core. Tunisia is a country that has great possibilities, I believe, to modernize itself. And the United States should not interfere with those processes. That does mean something specific for a start. It means moving away from support of World Bank and IMF structural adjustment programs, which have, I would argue, wounded Tunisia significantly. So that's changing the way that the United States looks at economic aid to Tunisia. That needs to change. The second thing is I fail to see why it is that the main relationship between the United States and Tunisia has to be based on a common alliance in what's called the war on terrorism. I think that this entire policy has to be reviewed. And one of the things that it exposed is, and it's needless to say not the first time, that when it comes to what is really the high priority of U.S. foreign policy, it's not democracy and economic development as much as it is engaging the leadership of a small country in U.S. regional security issues. So defense and security and military considerations trump democracy every time, and that is really hopefully going to change. That's what needs to be changed in this foreign policy prestige.
With the return of exile leaders of the opposition party, such as Rashid Al-Ghannouchi, the leader of the Islamist Nahda party,
yes,
and Moncef Marzouki, the secular leftist, do you think a coalition government would be the best way forward for Tunisia?
I'm hesitant to say too much about, quote, what I think Tunisia needs. So the comments I would make are very generic, if you like. First, the movement to overthrow Ben Ali, which really transformed very quickly from one about economic issues to one of challenging the system politically, was, as I mentioned earlier, I believe, a classic example of a united front effort. The whole population was involved. And from poor to really quite prosperous. And the most important thing that I can think of is that the different sectors of Tunisian society be involved in the transition. From a distance, I do think that dissolving the old ruling party is important. The old ruling party really served the interests of these two families. This is not a party at this point that could be reformed. And while I don't think it's a good idea that there be the same kind of purge that the United States did to the Ba'ath Party in Iraq, I think the leadership of that party, of the party in Tunisia, which is called the Rassemblement Constitutionnel Démocratique, RCD, that the party should be dissolved. And the healthier elements, if you like, however the Tunisians decide that, should be incorporated into some new structure. In terms of the people you're mentioning, I think they have a place. I would hope they have a place in the future of the country, both of them. They're part of the soul. The soul of Tunisia over these past years, and I would hope that I know they have a contribution to make. So I would hope that what emerges from this is more important than the political parties at this point is some kind of program or vision, both for economic and political changes in the country that seems to be shaping up. And that a political process that takes into consideration the great range of democratic thought in Tunisia, that it will be represented. So we'll see. And of course, that's what the struggle is about right now. To what degree will the old structures be dismantled? To what degree will the political energies of those people that really helped engineer these changes be taken into consideration?
The last question, what do you think the Jasmine Revolution in Tunisia, its role as a domino effect in Algeria, Egypt, and Jordan? Because you must have heard there have been attempted self-immolation of civilians.
Yes.
Yeah. So what do you think that Tunisia's role to play?
The most important thing one can say about this, well, a couple of things. One, again, is... earlier you referred to Twitter and Facebook and all this stuff. I want to ask it played a role. It did. But people need to remember who started the protests. The poorest of the poor, the working class in Tunisia, okay? My hunch is that a lot of these people were not on Facebook, did not have cell phones, and were not involved in Twitter, all right? So this is a movement from deep inside. Are you there? Did I lose you?
No, I'm here.
Okay, all right, sorry. This is a movement that comes really from the soul of this country. And that's not to take away from how these other factors, if you like, contributed. This movement gave people throughout the Middle East hope. You talk to people from different countries in the Middle East, doesn't matter whether we're talking Algeria, Tunisia, Yemen, Jordan, the sense of frustration and hopelessness of people. What is it that the Tunisians I'm meeting here in the United States are so bitter about the country that they come from and what was going on. And now all of a sudden that bitterness has been changed to hope. This is region-wide. And it's region-wide because even though each country has a different, if you like, route to the present day, the problems, the structural problems, are more or less the same. And it comes back to these three problems. One, high levels of unemployment. Secondly, corruption, whether it's a royal family in Saudi Arabia, whether it's the military in Algeria, whether it was the Ben Ali, Trabalsi mafia clans in Tunisia, a massive corruption at the top. And the third element is repression. So people throughout the region can identify with what's going on in Tunisia in a very, very profound manner. Now, how this will play out ultimately is hard to tell. Basically, the bottom line is this, that the events in Tunisia burst the bubble of first of all, any kind of economic miracle. They keep talking about the Tunisian miracle is nonsense, but also burst the bubble of regional development. And now we see a region with all of its warts and problems and shortcomings, and we see throughout the region people who hope to address these in a positive way. Needless to say, we should not expect that this is going to be easy for the people involved, but it's a new day, and that's what we can all thank the Tunisian people for starting this process, for basically, if you like, since everyone likes to use the image of the veil when it comes to the Middle East, ripping the veil off the image of, quote, the moderate countries in the Middle East that aren't so moderate. And this is what Tunisian people did. Great thing.
Thank you, Robert, so much. That's all the time we have for today. I know that we're calling you while you're on a trip to Washington, so thank you so much for giving us this opportunity to talk about Tunisia. If our listeners would like to follow Robert's articles and his news, he has his own blog, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's http robertjprince.wordpress.com.
That'll do it.
All right. Thank you so much.
If you just Google Rob Prince blog, it'll come up.
All right.
And
perfect.
Thank you, and nice speaking to friends in Toronto.
Yeah.
You take care.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye. We're going to listen to a song by Dutch Moroccan singer Kashmir Hakim. It's called the Vendor Cart Song. This is a new song dedicated to Embu Azizi, who self-immolated himself December 17th and died on January 4th, 2011. And the song is also dedicated to all the other people that fought and fight for peace and equality, justice, and a future for Tunisia.
Of a good job, a house, and a caravan. darkness you will never be around. Push and push, dragging myself over that state of mind to reach my shell. Grab for a book that I've studied when graduated. It said democracy's ready when votes are.
Welcome back to CHRY 105.5 FM, and you're listening to Amal Shivji on African Perspectives. listening to an interview from realnews.com with Samir Shihata, an ISIN professor of Arab politics at Georgetown University. Just to let you know, right now you are listening to Salam Ya Baladi by Mahmoud El Asili, an Egyptian singer.
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Paul Jay in Washington. The Tunisian ex-president remains in Saudi Arabia. After 23 years in power, Zine al-Abidine Ben Ali was ousted by thousands of people in the streets of Tunisia in what, at least for people observing from the West, was a somewhat unexpected development. Now joining us in our Washington studio to discuss the significance of these events is Samir Shihata. He's an assistant professor of Arab politics at Georgetown University. He's author of the book Shop Floor Culture and Politics in Egypt. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
So, first of all, give us the basics of what's happened for people that haven't followed the story very well.
Sure. On December 17th, a young Tunisian man, 26 years old, Mohamed Bouaziz, set himself on fire. And he set himself on fire in front of a police station in Tunisia because he was frustrated with his plight. He was a college graduate. He couldn't find meaningful employment. He was forced to sell fruits and vegetables in the market in his town. And the security forces confiscated his stand, and because he didn't have the proper paperwork, and apparently he was roughed up quite a bit. And so in protest, he lighted himself on fire and subsequently died. And this caused a wave of protests throughout Tunisia from December the 17th up until several days ago, continuing, that eventually grew and grew. The Tunisian security forces used significant amounts of repression, live ammunition. The figures of the dead so far range from the official figure of about 26 to the unofficial figure of about 60-something. And Tunisians were aware of what was going on as a result of video that was taken on cell phones and video cameras, posted on the web and so on. And the protests culminated in thousands of people in front of the Interior Ministry in Tunis, the capital, and then the President Zine al-Abidine Ben Ali fled on Friday.
Ben Ali was seen by people, is this correct, as a more or less Western-friendly leader?
Yes, very much so. He was very close with President Sarkozy. He had visited the White House on an official visit under George Bush. Condoleezza Rice paid him a visit in 2008.
So he would have been, people that remember from the 1960s, there was this thing called the Friendly Dictator's Deck of Cards. He would have been in the Friendly Dictator.
Very much so. I mean, Tunisia, of course, isn't the recipient of billions of dollars of aid like Egypt, but he was considered a very serious partner in America's war on terrorism. He was very open market, World Bank, IMF policy friendly. He believed that Islamists were the enemy, and he clamped down on Islamists quite severely without any regard for human rights or democratic process when he came to power until the present. So he was very much Western aligned with France and Europe as well as the United States.
And the conditions in terms of the political conditions for this kind of mass uprising, really, how organized was this? And this is just people fed up and coming into the streets. And again, it's for people that don't know, and as I have come to learn, a very repressive state.
Yes. Well, for those of us who study the Arab world, and of course the Arab world unfortunately is full of autocratic authoritarian regimes, Tunisia was considered the closest thing to a police state, aside from, of course, Saddam Hussein's Iraq. The Islamists were officially banned. There are many Tunisian political leaders in exile in Paris and in London. Elections are farcical regularly. Ben Ali has changed the constitution a number of times in order to allow himself to run again for president. In fact, it was well believed that he was going to amend the constitution another time to remove the age limit because he was 74 and The age limit in the Tunisian constitution is 75 for the post of presidents. We could run again in the next elections in 2014. So it was a very much of an authoritarian state. There were no press freedoms, no meaningful political participation. And it was unexpected, not only here in the United States, but in the region and among those of us who study Middle East politics.
So what sparked this? The people to have the confidence to come out, face the guns? And also, I saw one shot of people facing soldiers guarding the palace, and the soldiers seemed rather friendly to the people at that point. Did one see then splits in the army, splits in the police force?
Right, very much so. In fact, it seems that one key moment in the unfolding of events was when the army chief of staff resigned because he was unwilling to use the army against the civilian population demonstrating without arms, whereas the security forces that were very much aligned with Ben Ali and the regime were quite willing to use violence against civilians. And in fact, over the last few days, there have been instances recorded of fighting between the army and the forces loyal to Ben Ali, the security forces. So that was a key moment. And in terms of what started this, it's difficult to pinpoint anything, you know, a particular grievance other than the general kind of rising prices, inflation, youth marginalization, incredible corruption that was well known to Tunisians by the royal family, as it were, particularly Ben Ali's wife. This is well documented in the WikiLeaks that have come out, but of course Tunisians knew this before. So it were those kinds of frustrations and no political room for any kind of participation, contestation that I think ultimately led to this.
What message does that send then to the region that in a place that's one of the most police states, as you described, people reached a point? And it didn't matter. I guess there's a point where you say, I've got nothing to lose. They let them shoot. I'm going out in the streets anyway. And a lot of people came to that conclusion.
Yes, well, we've already seen ripple effects throughout the region. And citizens as well as leaders are very much concerned. We have already seen four Algerians also try to burn themselves in protest of unemployment, lack of a future for themselves. We've seen this occur in Mauritania as well. An Egyptian tried to light himself on fire in front of the Egyptian parliament and so on. So we've seen also a great deal of solidarity expressed by people in the Arab world with Tunisia, who have really are champions or heroes now, set a model for what was considered impossible, because this really is historic. I mean, this is the first time that an autocratic leader has been deposed by the power of ordinary people, mass protests in the Arab world. We've never seen anything like this before. We haven't had an Iranian revolution in the Arab world. Unfortunately, leaders are removed from power or leave power in the Arab world when they die or when there is a coup. That's the norm. So this really is quite different. And its effects have been already felt throughout the region.
Is there something specific about what happened in Tunisia in the sense that Ben Ali had so suppressed the Islamist movement that this kind of split that perhaps you see in Egypt or maybe some other places, where a section of the secular non-Islamist population is wary of a Muslim takeover? They don't want Sharia law, and sort of a split happens in the people's movement where you have a stronger Islamist presence. In Tunisia, having so suppressed the Islamist movement, did it actually create some space for a more unified spontaneous movement this way?
I think that there's something there. I mean, you're definitely right that a major divide, rift throughout the entire region in terms of politics and political opposition is that between Islamists and secularists. Whether it's Turkey or Egypt, this is the major political divide. I think that's partially responsible. But I think also something else is that Tunisia, as we said, was really close to a police state. There were no safety valve channels that people could release some of their frustrations. Elections were farcical, always. Legitimate political parties really were non-existent. Leaders were exiled in abroad. In countries like Morocco, Jordan, Egypt and so on, it's a kind of softer authoritarian. They're still thugs in charge, but they allow elections of different degrees of fraudulence.
But wasn't
and so
this
on.
Last election in Egypt?
It was terrible.
I mean,
however, in Egypt, there are opposition parties. The Muslim Brotherhood, as you mentioned, does operate. And in the past parliament, they had 88 people in the parliament. In the previous parliament, they had 17 people. There is an independent media in Egypt. Of course, there's also media repression, but there is regular criticism of the regime and so on. None of this was heard of in Tunisia. So another possibility is that, without being overly academic, is that semi-authoritarian regimes, regimes that allow some freedoms, as it were, can last longer. They can absorb opposition. They can withstand criticism and so on. Whereas these regimes that are completely authoritarian are much more brittle, are much more open to falling, as it were, if in the case of something like this, a mass movement develops.
Something we did a story covering the Egyptian elections, and there was a protest, a demonstration at some point, which I wonder how much significance it had, because in theory it should have a lot, which secular organizations protested alongside the Muslim Brotherhood, denouncing the elections as a fraud, and they were together. And you didn't find this sort of secular fear of the Muslim Brotherhood, at least in that space. Is that something that's growing there?
It is, and I think it is growing largely because the regime in Egypt has become more repressive, more authoritarian. As you mentioned, the elections were abysmal even by Egyptian standards. But there have been instances of Islamist secular cooperation in Egypt and elsewhere even before. In the 1984 elections, without too much history, the Muslim Brotherhood cooperated with the most secular parties, the WEFT in Egypt, to run candidates. In 87, they cooperated with other parties and so on. They're organized in the Kefaya, the Enough to Mubarak movement and so on. So there have been instances of cooperation as well as major division.
Now, when the people in the streets of Tunisia look at the United States and its policy, what do they see?
Well, the real bad culprits are the French, of course, who have been with Ben Ali for quite some time, from the very beginning, in fact. And in fact, a week ago or so, there were French ministers who were making statements that Ben Ali really wasn't as bad as people believed he was, that he wasn't really a dictator and so on. At the same time, however, the United States has been a supporter of this regime. They have been close partners in the so-called war on terrorism. President Ben Ali paid an official visit to the White House under the Bush administration, and often Tunisia is heralded as a model of economic reform. In fact, the Middle East Partnership Initiative by the State Department is headquartered in Tunis. That is supposed to promote liberalization and economic reform and political freedoms and so on. So Ben Ali was supported by the United States. There's no question about that. As are other many other
most of the dictators,
most of them,
the
yes, yes.
So, just one final question: one of the leaders of an Islam, the bigger Islamist party, which apparently he's planning to come back now, he said Ben Ali's gone, but the structure of the dictatorship has not. So, yeah, what's left and who's in power now? And
yes, that's Rashid Ghannouchi, the head of the Nahda party, said that, and he's completely correct. Whatever one thinks of him, that unfortunately it seems that the basic remnants of the Ben Ali regime are still there. And now the struggle is, to what extent is there going to be a complete break from the past? To what extent are people who were implicated in one way or another, maybe not directing the security forces to pull the trigger on civilians protesting, but were implicated in the regime, defenders of the regime, ideologues of the regime, apparatchiks, as it were, to what extent are they going to be allowed to stay in power, whether it's going to be the Ben Ali regime without Ben Ali, or a genuine new, more participatory, more democratic regime? And that's the struggle, I think.
And are there demands which are essentially against this neoliberalism, against the IMF, World Bank, and free market philosophy? Is this part of what the crowds are saying?
Yes, they're in choate, in a way, these types of demands. But that's what many of the basic criticisms were, about incredibly high inflation, about an economy that seemed to increase income inequality, limited opportunities, employment for youth and others, and so on, and this kind of merciless neoliberal economic package that has been you know, pushed by the IMF, the World Bank, and the United States for quite some time. Tunisia was referred to as an economic miracle because of the high rates of growth. And in fact, they were high rates of growth. But as many people have said, you know, average citizens don't eat macroeconomic statistics. And this is the problem, that on paper, the economies look quite good. But when you really get down to income inequality, who gets what, as it were, things look significantly different.
So this is just the beginning. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
And we'll continue to follow the story in Tunisia on the Real News Network.